Hi everyone, it's Eli. You know how sometimes you stumble upon something truly game-changing in healthcare? Well, I found it. Kinetisense. This cutting-edge motion capture technology is transforming movement, assessment, and recovery. Imagine getting instant AI-driven insights without any wearables on your patient. That's right, no ping pong balls needed. Just pure, accurate data. Perfect for boosting athletic performance, pinpointing imbalances, and refining rehab. Top professionals worldwide trust Kinetisense to maximize productivity and results. Check out our partner page to learn more. Experience the revolution in movement. Welcome to Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More, the podcast that gives you a viewpoint in sports medicine that can't be found anywhere else. I'm your host, Eli Halleck, and we have a fantastic show ahead of us today. So let's get started. Welcome to Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More. Today, our guest is Tony Bellini of XPE Sports. How are you doing, Tony?
How are you doing, Mr. Eli? I'm doing great today.
Thanks for joining us today. I know we've been working on trying to get this set up for a little while, and I'm kind of excited because you have a very unique career, kind of exciting, kind of energetic, and it's really fascinating. The more I read about you, the more I want to know. So I'm really happy we're sitting down today.
I appreciate the kind words. Energetic, I guess, is good as we get older.
Especially in our field, right?
Yes, sir.
So if you can give us a little background about yourself, what you do, where you went to school, the whole nine yards, let our listeners know.
The short version is went to school at Myrtle Beach High School, as anybody in South Carolina should. Smart enough and cares about sports like I do, they should go to Clemson University. So that's where I went.
Love that.
Dad was a doctor. I thought I was going to go into pre-med. He convinced me not to be a doctor and told me to own my own business instead, but I didn't think he thought I was going to become what he called a gym teacher. So I got a master's degree in exercise science from George Washington University, and he kept asking what I was going to do with that. I said, I don't know. I think I want to teach people how to run fast. And he's like, so you're going to teach people how to run fast. So he didn't really believe in my career, but well, it kind of turned into working with the Washington Capitals as an intern, the Orlando Magic as a more of a glorified intern, almost as an employee, and then finally getting my first break into kind of what I fell in love with, which was speed and agility training with Chris Carter's FAST program back in 1999. Back in 1999, Chris Carter and Randy Moss, specifically along with others, were training in a specific way that was way ahead of their time. They, not saying they didn't lift weights, but they weren't concentrating on weight training. Not saying they didn't try to condition, but they weren't concentrating on conditioning. They were concentrating on how to get fast and quick and explosive. And that kind of just opened up my eyes to what my passion was of trying to get people to move athletic. So that's when in 2002, I started up XPE Sports and moved to Atlanta, worked with a bunch of great players that believed me as a 28-year-old. I knew what I was doing. And then a decade later, moved it back down to South Florida and kept XPE going and created the Shredmill. So it's been about 25 years as a business owner. A lot of business war stories of what not to do, and a lot more of what not to do, and then some things that work. But what stayed consistent is the training approach and the training of the athletes getting, I guess, great results is just kind of easy and fun.
And I love how you mentioned that the emphasis was not on weightlifting, which back then, or even some avenues and some alleys today, that's all they focus on is the weightlifting, not the speed, the agility, fast twitch muscles. So that must have been eye-opening when they looked at you and said, here's what we're working on.
And that started it. I mean, back then we still conditioned with 110s, right? 110s. Now 110s are like, oh, never do them. Right. But I remember we were still conditioning with 110s because It was like, well, we're not going to run miles. We'll do 110s, right? Now it's like back. That was back in 1999 to 2002. And then about 2010, I even transitioned away from 110. Why are we even doing 110? We can condition, get in good shape without even doing 110. So I stopped doing 110s 15 years ago. And now that's kind of mainstream to where you don't even condition with 110, right? But it's still not accepted, but you don't need it. Just too much of the science and results that are now achieved with proper scheduling of speed, agility, strength, power training. There's too much data out there now for people to be doing it incorrectly. And it's not my way to be correct. It's just a proven way, like I said, with too many athletes, too many coaches, too much data, too much science to be doing it incorrectly. Unless if your coach is just, what I hear a lot, well, this is what I did. You know, this is what I did 10 years ago, 15 years ago. This is what I did 30 years ago. That's the only excuse now. But it's still a viable excuse out there that even I have to fight.
Now, question for you. We do have some listeners not as up to date on some information. Can you explain to them what the 110s are?
110s are just running 110 yards, basically goal line to goal line, or, you know, end zone to end zone. And the old test used to be try to get done in 15 to 17 seconds, one run every minute. So 15 on, seconds on, 45 seconds off. We used to build up to doing like 20 of them at the end of the workout. You know,
yikes.
It was a common condition. It used to be a common conditioning test done. It's not done anymore. So if NFL teams and everybody else has quit doing it, you hope it transfers down. But like I said, I haven't done it for 15 years. Not just me, but what people like me try to do is, and I'm not the only one. I mean, we literally try to stay 5 to 10 years ahead of the curve of what's accepted. And I know what I know, and I know it works with athletes. And sometimes it takes 5 to 10 years for it to be proven by science. And then it takes another 5 to 10 years for people to adopt it. So 110s are not needed. I'm not saying they're bad, but they're just not needed.
Well, I know when I had to run them way back when in the old days, I didn't think they were needed too, but that's because I was trying not to puke while I was running them. So, you know.
But that's the main thing. Like, that's what made me my, like when I was young, I was beating every NFL player at every drill we did. And I'm like, okay, if I'm beating 20 Hall of Fame, all pro players out here on these drills, we're doing something wrong. Because I shouldn't be beating them. And the only reason I could beat them was because I was in better shape than them, because I was 170 pounds. And they're 190 to 250, like for skill players, right? So if getting in shape and being able to outwork an NFL player was an indication of how good you were at football, I should have been in the Hall of Fame, right? And I couldn't touch a college field. So I quickly understood real quickly that this isn't what makes NFL players great. So I started picking apart what makes them great and then tried to develop drills that would make them better at what makes them great.
So you mentioned what makes them great. So what are some of the big marks that you would see when you were starting this out that made someone great in that arena? What did you notice?
Well, what first made me knowledgeable or good was fast 40 results, because that was, if you go run fast, you're going to be good at football.
Speed is speed. Yep.
Speed is speed. So I started looking at it. So we started having the fastest, most explosive players in NFL combine history. I mean, that was back in 2006 to 2008, we were doing that.
Yeah,
almost 20 years ago.
I was looking at your data and some of the times the guys had coming out of your programs. It was damn impressive.
Yeah, I mean, recently, the last 3 years, I think there's been 8 or 9 4.30s and under, and we have everyone but one.
Holy
everyone
moly.
But one. And there's not one company that has more than 1.42 at the NFL Combine, and we have 7 or 8. So if you go by results, we're the best at 40-yard dash. Now, people will argue and say, well, they already get fast guys, and I have to quickly remind people, I had to build myself up with great results in order to get some fast guys, but we improve fast guys 2 to 3 tenths of a second. And sometimes people don't believe it, and that's okay. So I was speed all in back in 2006 to 2010. And then I started looking at the guys that were getting these great results at Indy and started monitoring their NFL performance. And it wasn't speed anymore. It was one, and everybody says it, availability, right? You can't be hurt. When you're hurt, somebody else gets your job. And that's the same in high school. When you're hurt, somebody else gets in. So it was more like injury prevention and agility training of how to get ahead that I didn't realize back then. But using agility training to help counteract speed gains was a great injury prevention vaccine, let's say. I started noticing guys were getting hurt by not having exposures to sprint training, and sprint training fixed that. But then they were getting hurt by being too fast. And when you're too fast and can't stop, you get hurt. So we started using agility training 15 years ago as a vaccine for injury prevention. And we started to train speed as track guys, but agility training for conditioning. And that's what we started 15, 16 years ago. I was lucky. I was at the Duke University K Lab in 2002, and they showed me a study they were doing about ACLs happening because people couldn't break enough. Right now, it's common knowledge that when you go too fast and try to stop, you know, your ACL blows.
Yep.
I knew that in 2002 because I was luckily at the K Lab. My dad, who played football at Duke, set me up an interview there. And that was like one study they were working on. And I just watched. And I watched how they show girls landing and their knees wobble. I watched. They studied 90 non-contact ACL injuries, and they were all done when they were trying to break. And I watched it like 3 years before the study came out. And I started watching all the ACLs happen on kickoffs, on receivers trying to stop. So I was saying it back in 2000s, not because of anything I knew. I was in the right place, one time. Every time someone would try to stop, and he'd get hurt and he'd jog off the field, and the announcers would be like, "Oh, he's all right. He's jogging it off." I'm like, "No, he tore his ACL."
No, he's not. We know what that is. Yep. Yep. Yep.
But I got lucky. So I really realized like early 2000s that we had to stress back pedals, start and stops, deceleration, correct agility, correct foot placement to really succeed in the NFL. So that was like the first level of it. And then we kept putting out great 40 yard dash results. And I thought I had a good system of when to do speed, when to do agility, when to do strength. But I met Darrell Revis getting ready for his last year of his NFL career. And like stars aligning again. I mean, I believe in God, but I don't believe everybody has to. But there's something out there that's helping people.
Yes, there is.
He put Darrell Revis in my life going into his last year. Now, I had trained great players before. And I had trained great DBs before, but I got them fast and then implemented my system. I never had a great DB like that come to me after a 12-year Hall of Fame career and say, "Hey, get me ready for year 13 or whatever." And I was like, "Ooh, all right, come on." So he jumped in with like 20 guys. And I thought he was doing some drills incorrectly. And he agreed. And I was like, why am I sitting here fixing Darrell Revis? Like, I better stop. It made me feel like I was fixing him and banging my chest in front of all the guys that trained with us to show everyone that trained with me, we're right. And even Darrell Revis can't do it. That's how I felt in my mind, because why am I correcting one of the greatest DBs ever on how to get in and out of breaks and not anybody else? And it really worried me for like a week. And Darrell Revis, the ultimate Hall of Famer, it's not like these new age cats. New age cats, you tell them they're doing something wrong, they're going somewhere else. Darrell Revis almost read my mind. I don't know how. Came up to me after a session and said, "Hey, that drill you're trying to get me to fix?" I go, "Yeah." I go, "It was just because your foot was out of position and everybody else may not be as good as you, but their foot was in position." He goes, "Oh, no, no, you're exactly right. Keep fixing." Now, this is Revis, right?
That's so cool. And that's so cool.
It gave me so much confidence of some of the stuff that I had created. Not that I played with, but that I learned from others was worked. But then it went into supercharge. Anquan Boldin went into his last year at Buffalo and then just decided to retire. Literally went to Buffalo, came back 2 days later. Revis was guaranteed money with the Jets, so he didn't have to start playing until week 8 to 10. So he got to sit out and just pick what team he wanted to play for. And I had Anquan Boldin and Darrell Revis alone with me for 8 weeks of the football season. And we trained 3 to 4 days a week every morning and talked about football. Both those guys are amazing men too. How much they help people. Like Anquan, big on education and youth. Revis, big on childhood poverty with hunger, like nutrition.
Right.
and youth. And both of them are an open book and will help anyone,
Oh, that's
even with football.
fantastic. You always love to hear
And they
those kind of guys giving back and helping out others and making a difference.
yeah.
That's nice.
They help me, and this is what I tell everybody. I'm sitting there asking them, how do we become great at a wide receiver learning how to attack and get to a certain spot, and a defender trying to take that away? Now, everybody's always going to say, well, the receiver has it easy because he knows where he's going. They're exactly wrong. The receiver has it hard because he has to go to a predetermined spot and can't change his mind. That's hard. The NFL receiver has to be the ultimate illusionist, the ultimate show speed, show movement, but get to point A to B as fast as he can. He has to be the ultimate artist and scientist at the same time. Artist is, I show you whatever you want. You may interpret a lot of different ways. A scientist gets the A to B the fastest. 40-yard dash, A to B the fastest. A receiver has to get to this spot in 2.5 seconds or less, and he's got the best guy in the world that knows how to take it away. Receiver's hard. So I started looking at a receiver and like, that's a basketball player. The goal is set. The defender knows I'm trying to get to this goal, but I got to become an artist to get around him. And if I take too much time to get around them, I'm bringing more players into the play. So I got to be a scientist. And I can't go too fast because if I go too fast, I'm already bringing too many people into play. I got to keep them on my hip. That's what Luka Doncic said. Like, the receiver is the ultimate playmaker for I have a planned point of attack and I'm getting to where I want to go in as few seconds as possible, and you're not stopping me. So I
Love
looked
it.
at like Anquan Boldin, Chris Carter, and how all these receivers were learning how to get to a predetermined spot and started using it for everyone that had to get to a certain spot on a quarter field. But I never had a guy like Revis who's supposed to take it away. So I started asking Revis, how do we take it away? Now, Anquan was always in my head of, hey, Tony, you're getting your guys so fast, but they don't need to be that fast. I'm like, what do you mean? The faster I go, the faster I can run routes. Anquan's like, you couldn't be more wrong. He's like,
Interesting.
the faster you go, the crappier you're going to run routes. So I was like, let me think about that. Let me go back and look at all the top catchers in NFL history. Randy Moss, I trained. He's a 4-2, 4-3 guy. I think Torrey Holt is up there. That's it. All the rest are 4-5 and slower guys. Like, maybe Anquan's onto something. That's why all the receivers that I have that run 4-2, 4-3s aren't the best wide receivers. So I started believing Anquan, and I kept saying, but if we run faster, we can change the directions faster. No, makes it worse. So I took a leap of faith and believed Anquan. Anquan's like, we run routes at 14, 16 miles an hour. I'm like, man, that's so slow. But now if you look at GPS, that's what the game is played at,
That's
football, 12 to
accurate.
18 miles an hour. He had a GPS before GPS was, right? So Anquan was really coaching me on all this because I trained Anquan like from 2008 till 2014 or 15 when I started training. So I had known Anquan's system. And I got Revis. I'm like, Revis, what are we trying to do here? Revis looked at me and said, play basketball, buddy. Play basketball. You play hoop. We play hoop. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, not run. He goes, once when I have to run to guard someone, I'm out of control. They got me where they want me. I'm like, wait. So Anquan's trying to run as slow as possible, but show speed. You're trying not to run at all to guard him. And I looked at them both. I said, so both of y'all tell me whoever's running on that field is losing. They said, exactly. So that's mind blowing. I was like, nobody believes y'all. And they're like, who cares? So that was in 2014, I think. But then it took me 4 or 5 more years not to develop a system of improving it and drills that do that, but proving what they were talking about works. So, for example, a lot of people do laser fly times now
Yep,
instead of
that's
40-yard dashes.
super popular nowadays, no doubt about it.
All that means is instead of a guy running in a straight line 40 yards, and there's always air. Like you, if one guy goes and runs a 40 for 10 different people on 10 different surfaces with 10 different timing systems, he's getting 10 different times, right?
So true, so
Even at
true.
the NFL Combine. Don't even get me started talking about it. They have ruined the efficacy of timing at the NFL Combine because of TV. But that's all right. But the way you can try to take the air out is to set up two lasers as a fly con. Just for your run through a laser, it goes beep. You run through another laser, it goes beep. It gives you a machine that had no human error, right? I started doing what's called a 5 to 10 fly. A lot of people do it, and maybe they did it before me, but I started doing this in 2014 because I was like, how fast you are between 5 to 15 yards is what I want to use as a barometer for game speed. Because most plays, even inside, like you have up to 15 yards to accelerate, and you're either turning into a sprint or having to shut down and stop and make a change of direction before 15
So true.
yards. So that was called my game speed test, 5 to 10 fly, right? And I started noticing that even big guys, like there was very little difference in someone super fast and not that fast. There's a few hundredths of a second. So I started to get a stopwatch and I hit it as fast as I could. And normally you can hit a stopwatch a blink of an eye, about 0.12 to 0.15.
Yep.
Right? Well, every player on that field is running like within 0.12 to 0.15 of each other. Slow guys are maybe running 1.35. And fast guys are maybe running 1.20. Even on a high school football field, like
yep.
Everyone's within a blink of an eye of each other on a 15-yard run. So I was like, it's all on who gets a blink of an eye ahead. If I can get a blink of an eye ahead of someone, it's hard for them to make up that space.
It's
and everybody
over
thinks,
at that
no,
point.
I make,
yep.
You know, they're like, no, I make it up with speed. No, you make it up by getting a blink of an eye ahead. So that was one way that I started showing it to people. Hit a stopwatch as fast as you can, right? And quit celebrating that you improved your 5-10 fly from 1.25 to 1.22. I mean, we do it sometimes, but, oh, you got 300s faster. I'm like, who cares? When you change directions better. Because right when you change directions poorly or don't control your speed, you lose a tenth and a half of a second at least. So that was one way. Then we did a 5-10 fly where run 5 yards in, and at 5 yards, you just got to turn. So it's called a 90-degree roll test. So you go 5 yards, go through the laser, instead of 10 yards straight, you go 5 yards and have to hit a bend, another 5 yards, 90-degree roll test. We have found the best athletes in the world can get through that test in 1.50 seconds. Okay? When they try to go faster, you know what?
05.
50 seconds.
1.50. 1.50. Wow.
So I started thinking about it. We tried to go faster, you know what would happen? Their times would slow down to 1.60, 1.70. In fact, when you first do that test with people, they're all in 1.7s, 1.8s. And you know what you got to tell them? Slow down. And then they start to slow down, and you know what happens to their time? It speeds up. I was like,
that's crazy.
Bolton was right.
That's crazy.
So a lot of people follow that now, game speed. It's called the game speed roll 90 test. We want our elite athletes to be 1.20 on a 5.10 straight line, 1.20 seconds. And that means they're averaging like 17 miles an hour through that zone. So if you're averaging 17 miles an hour from 5 to 15 yards, you're getting in at 15, coming out at 19. You're fast enough, and you haven't even tried to run yet. Then if you stand up and run, you're going 21, 22 miles an hour. So we call that 5 to 15 the mile zone, our game speed zone, of how easily can we get in the 1.2s. What I mean, how easily? Can I just push off the ground and continue my movement and be fast enough? That's what receivers do. They don't sprint and then change directions. They push and move and then put all their energy on the change of direction instead of the sprinting. It's that's an art, but it's hard to understand. But what was crazy about the roll test was every time people would come in, I did it to Cam Jordan. I'm 49 years old. I know the secret because Revis and Anquan told it to me. Cam thinks he knows it, but he doesn't even know it. So Cam comes and trains with us. He's year 10, 11 in his career, superstar stud. I conclude Mark Ingram, because this is Buddy and Cam on a group text. Mark knows exactly what I'm doing because I've trained him his whole career. I say, Cam, we're going to run a bend test, like how quick you can bend and get to the quarterback, a 90-degree roll test, speed
which is something he does every damn game, right? Yep.
And I said, I'm going to whoop your ass as a 50-year-old white guy. So I'm getting mad. I'm willing to bet you anything, right? So we get there. I set up the test. He goes, well, what are you going to do? And I show him, and I'm like, look, all we're doing is running 5 yards, and then after 5 yards, we got to go five and whip it around. You know, he's like, all right. So I show it to him. I was like, you want me to go first or second? He goes, I'll go first. I said, cool. You better go fast because I'm going to whoop you. It's over. He tries to go too fast. He gets like 1.88 seconds. So Mark Ingram last. I get up there. I don't trot through it, but I go two steps of speed, move, hit a good roll, and I'm 1.71 seconds. And
what was the look on his face at that point before he even said
anything? He goes, there's no way that was 1.71 seconds. I'm like, I've got a laser right here. I said, you want to know the secret? He goes, what? I said, slow down. I was like, you can't run a turn at full speed. Move, hit the turn smooth, and run out of it. He goes, then he drops to 174. He drops a tenth and a half with just that one simple coaching. Okay? So now what we do is we bring elite guys, DBs, receivers. Now Cam's getting 170, and they try to beat Cam, and they're all 170s. I'm like, how are y'all elite DBs and receivers not able to beat this 280-pound DN? Right?
Yeah, right. Right, totally.
You're going too fast. Slow down. Anquan walks up. Hey, guys, you're changing direction 10 yards down there. Don't run 10 yards and change. Push two steps. Run 2 to 3 yards, move, and then change. That's route running 101. That's playing in control. That's Luka Doncic 101. Okay? So then all the skill guys do that, and they drop it down into 1.5s. Okay? Very few NFL players. There's some. Denzel Ward is one. Very few NFL players get into 1.5s when you just tell them what the test is. Denzel Ward is one of the greatest guys I've seen with application of game speed with teaching them nothing. Like, nothing. Denzel Ward ran a 4.3, low 4.3 at Indy. I didn't train him. He came and trained after his combine performance and said, I just want to work on agility. Doesn't even train speed anymore. He's falling into my system. But the amazing thing about that roll test is so many things are told that you go too fast, you get too slow. You're out of control, right? And what is 1.50 seconds? If you do the math, it's like 20.45 divided by 1.50 seconds. I think it's 12.7 miles an hour. So what miles per hour are you averaging? 12.7? Maybe you're getting up to 15. That means you're making the turn at 10 miles an hour because that's the average time. What did Anquan tell us we were running routes at? 12 to 16 miles an hour.
And he's right.
He's dead on. He knew everything before it even was existed. And we've come up with a whole, not a whole battery of tests, but how fast do you run straight versus how fast do you run a turn versus how fast do you go 5 yards and come back downhill. And we have a little system of what your drop-off should be. And we find with our elite high school guys is that they're faster than they think, but their agility is worse than they even know.
Yeah, I see that damn near every day, so I don't doubt that. Now, you're mentioning the high school ranks. What do you think is one of the more important pursuits of a high school athlete when he's really working on goals? What is probably one of these most important things for them to be working on at this point in their athletic career?
Most of these schools now sometimes have a great strength and conditioning coach, right? So,
very true. That's mandatory, almost. Yeah.
Like Mike Boyle is turned into a great mentor of mine, and he'll say it, but then you talk to him and you learn why. He'll say he's going to focus on speed training, and I don't want to misphrase it because I love him, but he focuses on speed and power training because they're getting agility training when they play their sport. And that's exactly correct, but it's wrong because if they only work on speed and speed and explosion training and don't work on agility training, their agility gets worse. Now, Mike's backup to that, and he's exactly right, is, well, if he only gets a kid 2 days a week, he's got to help fill his speed and explosion bucket, right? And he's exactly right with that. But for these kids that are training 4 days a week, 6 days a week, you can get everybody to their genetic potential in 4 to 6 weeks if you concentrate on speed and explosion correctly. And that's focused on speed and explosion Monday and Thursday with legs. Spend the other days not getting too tired on your legs and working on other things. So after 6 to 8 weeks, you're at the best genetic version of yourself. It's exactly what we got to do with NFL combine guys. They come to us after being elite athletes at great schools, but we have 6 to 8 weeks to get them to the fastest and most explosive version of themselves. We follow an NFL combine schedule. Now, if we take, and people don't believe it, but if we take an elite wide receiver from 4.71 to 4.46 in 8 weeks, which we do, right?
Wow.
One, that should tell you two things. Wait, these guys are catching all these footballs for the best universities in the world, but only running 4.6 and 4.7? Yeah. Wait, they got to train with you for 8 weeks to be a 4.4? Yeah. Does that mean my speed training is good, or does that mean you truly don't have to be a 4.4 to succeed in football on the high school level? There's tons of, like, they're not running that fast.
No, they're not.
So it tells you that one thing. But if we take them from 4.71 to 4.46 in 8 weeks, which we can do, What happens after that 8 weeks if we train him another 8 weeks? Do they go from 4.46 to 4.18? No.
No.
Do they even go from 4.46 to 4.32? No. You got to them to their genetic potential 6 to 8 weeks. Chalk it up and move on. Right? Now you get to work on agility and all that, and what we call just dose speed in effectively.
Elevate your knowledge, ignite your curiosity, and compete with the best minds at events hosted by the American Academic Competition Institute. AACI's sports medicine competitions feature practical exercises, challenging quizzes, specialty tests, and keynote speakers that foster knowledge and social engagement in healthcare and sports medicine. Go to AACITest.org for more information on upcoming regional and national competitions. Sign up for the Ultimate Intellectual Showdown. Talking about high school going from a 4.7 to a 4.4, does it get you down to a 4.1 in genetics and that whole ball game? And we really notice you can only take an athlete so far. At some point, you're going to hit what you call genetic potential, and that's it. That's all they can do. But then what do you work on?
Yeah, so that's what I do with any high school kid is I try to get him his genetic potential for speed and power as fast as possible. Let's say it's an eighth grade D tackle. He's whatever, 5'10". He runs a 5'6", and he's 230 pounds, right? Because he's an eighth grade. And we've taken that kid and we get him to 5'1" or two. Like we take 4 or 5 tenths off of him in 8 weeks because we focus on it. And then the dad is like, all right, can you get to be a 4.8? I said, no, not for a year or two. Like, well, what do you mean? Well, because now we've got this athlete who's 230, and he runs a 5.2. Now we just got to dose the appropriate speed and explosion. And every year, with just normal progressions, he's going to gain 1 pound per month and drop 1/10 per year if you do it correctly. So now, by his senior year, he's going to be 260 and running a 4.8. I said, that's going to be plenty enough, right?
Yeah.
And that's not coming from me anymore. That's from following a correct program now. So that's what we do is we do improve everyone's speed and power as much as they can in 6 to 8 weeks. And then Tony Holler says it, speed is the priority. And I say, but not the majority, right? And that's why people think we argue and we don't. It's just everybody's like, well, if I make speed the priority, I got to spend all my time on speed. No, you spend very little time on speed. You just structure your workout week around speed, and it keeps your speed gains. And then you get to work on strength and agility. So what's an appropriate schedule in my book? Everybody says jump, sprint, lift. I do agree with that, right? And we'll get into the treadmill next. The treadmill makes the sprint, the jump, sprint, lift just happen all at once. Right. But if you don't have a treadmill or a hill or sleds or any of that, and you can't do it all in one session, then you should do some jumping exercises first. Jump.
Right.
You should go do some sprinting exercises next. A lot of rest. That should maybe take 20 minutes total. You don't need to overdo it. And then you go lift for 40 minutes. There's your hour workout. You jump, you sprint, you lift. I would do legs that day because they all work together. Now, what do I do Monday? Well, Monday, your legs should be sore and tired because you worked them out. So if you tried to run again, it would suck, right? So you know what you can work on? You can flush out the legs with correct agility exercises because you should only be doing those at 12 to 16 miles an hour anyway, which is only 60 to 80% of your max speed if you're a 20-mile-an-hour guy. So now you can get a conditioning effect in with agility training on Tuesday. And you know what's not sore from Monday? Your upper body. Go ahead and crush your upper body then. So maybe do 20 minutes of appropriate agility training and then do 40 minutes of upper body training. Now on that back-to-back schedule of Monday or Tuesday, you've gotten some good gains in work opposite. So what would you do Wednesday? Well, Wednesday is, are you going to work out Friday or are you giving your kids off Friday? If you're not going to give them off Friday and you're going to work on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I treat Wednesday as a total rest day. Let them do something fun. Make sure their grades are up. Let them work flexibility. Let them work hand-eye coordination. Let them practice free throws. Let them practice catching balls. Let them practice shooting shots on a goal. Like something of active recovery, because then Monday for speed and power, you work Monday. You rinsed out your legs Tuesday. You rested them Thursday. Work, rinse, rest, And then you repeat. So then what can you do Thursday?
Work,
you go back,
rinse, rest. I like that. There you go. Repeat. Yep. Work, rinse, rest, repeat. That's nice. I like
now,
that.
Now I got a new Thursday, Friday, Saturday schedule. This is the same. Monday I go the same. Get my speed and power gains in. Crush my legs. Friday, my legs are going to be sore. Rinse them out with agility training and do some upper body. Saturday, you can rest, or you could go full on skill training Friday, because Saturday you could do upper body. The end of the week, you can manipulate. But now you've gotten everything you need into an appropriate schedule. And I don't think that's magic. I think a lot of people follow something similar. And most people you talk to that are getting good results are following a set schedule very similar to that, to 80 to 95% similar. It doesn't skew from that. And then the exercises they choose are probably less similar, but still high, probably 60 to 85% similar, to where you're not changing that schedule much. You can change the exercises some, but when you keep that the same, the scheduling is the big thing. And people get super, super fast, super, super soon, and they hold their speed in as long as you keep up that schedule.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Now, talking about speed and work, rest, rinse, repeat, which I'm going to be using that from now on. Hope you don't mind. You were talking about, it came up a second ago, the shred mill. Now, when I read that, I'm like, well, there's a hell of a term. I like it. That just rolls off the tongue. But then I looked at it and went, oh, my God, that looks like pain for, what is it, 90 inches by 40 inches? That's 90 by 40 of pain, but it looks like it's one hell of a gain. What led you to design it? And, well, first off, tell the listeners what the shred mill is and how it evolved.
So the shred mill is a manually powered treadmill that only moves off of the athlete's power, stride length, and frequency. So I knew very early on that the definition of speed was stride length times stride frequency. But I thought what was missing with that was power, right? And the power you generate can dictate so much more stride length than form, okay? So I looked into that early, and we were in Florida, and it's hard, even when we're in Florida, it's hard to get outside and train speed, especially when you're in a weight room gym. And I don't like jumping somewhere and then sprinting outside and then coming inside to lift. Like, I wanted to do it all in one session. So we used a bunch of Woodway treadmills because they would all break, like when you use them enough. And we had one set up flat and unplugged that you could push on, like a heavy prowler sled. We had one set up a hill unplugged that as you stride it out and got bigger and bigger, the belt would spin faster and faster. It would build your stride. And then we had another setup like at 20 miles an hour that you try to jump on and try to maintain your speed. And we would go squat or jump, accelerate, open up your stride, turn over your stride. That's the progression. You build up speed. You use power. You push off the ground. You open your stride. You turn over your stride. That's the speed progression right there. So I tried to create it all with these woodways and inside a weight room. And we were getting amazing results. And a guy came up to me and said, what are you really trying to do? I was like, well, it'd be cool if I could see how fast I'm going when I push this belt. It'd be real cool, too, if I had resistance system in. It'd be real, like, so we developed it, and it just worked so much better than I ever thought. And we were running on it the first day, and we were used to striding out on 15, 20 seconds up hills. So I designed this whole workout on a shred mill, and we had like 8 guys, all NFL players. And after a few runs, they were all on their back. And somebody said, that ain't a treadmill, that's a shred mill. And I'm like, yeah, it's probably. And then it's taught me more about anything. Well, what's the acceleration curve, Tony? Well, you get to 80% of your top speed in the first 2 seconds, 90% even. Like, that curve is like this. And then in 5 seconds, you should be at your top speed, right? It truly trains that acceleration curve like no other. And we do different settings on it based on, if you're weak at the power phase of sprinting, you can do a setting. If you're weak at the stride out phase of sprinting, you can do a setting. The app tells you what to work on. It's so simple. Like, once when we created it and it started working better than I ever thought, we just use that in our combine program every Monday, Thursday. And the simple put is, it kind of brings any hill or any type of sled or 1080 resistance training device, and any type of tracking software. So you can do speed training in your weight room. I mean, there's scientific research that shows that, you know, it directly correlates with speeds you hit on a 1080. Scientific research shows that the rate of acceleration is directly correlates with the ground. The research of just the combine results should be enough, but, you know, it's kind of hard to say that we train 20 guys at the combine every year out of 30. 20 out of 30, less than 10% of the population.
That's crazy.
Not 90% of the fastest times ever.
Oh, I'm looking at the 40-yard dash results, XPE top performers.
Yeah.
That's on the website from 2009 all the way up to 2020. And just those times are just stunning.
So it's kind of hard to say that you can say it and that's fine, that we just got lucky. You know, we literally have the smallest sample size of anyone with the best results ever. So I will take luck on that and say I'm the luckiest SOP ever, right? Because the odds just don't exist. But we follow a little bit of jump, sprint, lift, rest, repeat, but in the same session. Instead of doing it all at one time, you can do one, then the other, then the other, then rest and repeat. And once when your jumping metrics or your speed metrics or your weight metrics start to go down, you know what? They all start to go down. So then it's like, okay, we've done our dose. Now we're getting tired. Let's not do it anymore. Now all we're going to do is risk injury or teach our body to be slower.
Yep.
So it lets you do it in a controlled environment. And you just get fast. We say hashtag get fast, fast. You just get fast, fast. So simple.
Get fast, fast.
It's so simple.
Telling you what, I'm looking at this machine and it, granted, I'm a few years off of being a college athlete, but man, that just looks, that looks like it's going to make you work.
Yeah, it may, like, so you can put it on a heavy load to where it magically drops your max V into 50% of your max V. I didn't create it like that. Just that's how it ended up being created. And then studies came out saying, if you want to elicit the most power output, train resisted running at 50% of your max V. What does that mean? It's not hard. Let's say you're pulling a sled and you pull a sled for 20 yards, right?
Got it.
Well, to do this easily, put a laser between 10 and 20 without any resistance and see if they get, let's say, 1.20 seconds through that fly. Okay, now pull a sled through that fly time. You shouldn't slow down more than twice that. So if I can pull it, if I'm free running at 1.2, I shouldn't do a sled heavier than something that slows me down more than 2.4 seconds. So once when you do that, you're at 50% of your max speed. People for so long train sleds too heavy. You don't
and
need
they
to
still,
train
still
sleds
do because that's what the still that's do. What the coaches knew or know or what they went through. So they just pitch it at the kids.
Our shred mills, when our guys are running 22, 23 miles an hour at Indy, they could always push our shred mill belt to 11, 12, 13 miles an hour. And I'm like, I want it heavier. How can we make the resistance heavier? We couldn't put our patented magnetic resistance system any closer, any more magnet. That was it. Like, we couldn't get it heavier. And for 3 years, I tried to figure out how to make it heavier. And then research came out, and I was like, that's why these guys are running so fast. Because every time they're doing a dose of all intent running with me the past 4 to 5 years, they're doing it at the appropriate speed that elicits the most forceful output by science. I kind of got lucky, but it worked.
Hey, sometimes luck is a beautiful thing, right? A little bit is always good. Yep.
Yep.
You mentioned one thing that I wanted to jump in, and I know we talked about briefly in the beginning when you and I were just talking about the medical side. So you said something, and it's so true, and some people don't think about it. You hit a certain point, and they're tired. Their body can't do much more. And we see it at the high school level, where not where I work specifically, but just in general, because I work in the high school setting. Some of the kids, some of the coaches, club teams, stuff like that, they push them further than they should. And that's when we start to see injuries. How do you educate somebody to stay away from that danger zone, as I call it, where they start to get injured because they're overtraining?
It's so hard, but like it's going to be a fight forever. But like some of the best strength and conditioning coaches, one that comes to mind, Aaron Feld out of Miami, just recently in the last year or two has taught Cristobal how I'm monitoring all this stuff, and our injuries happen at this minute into practice when our performance drops. And he had to, like, and I'm not picking those two names, but like, even the most elite strength and conditioning coach, like Liefeld, with all the data in the world available to him, with guys wearing GPS and heart rates and stuff, it has taken time for even him to change an elite coach at the elitist level, right?
It's a mindset, and it's a mindset that's evolved for decades, really.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people now that are winning without being the hardest workers. And you just have to keep showing them, like, the treadmill works as a way to where if we're lifting and our bar speed is coming down, we're getting less explosive as the session goes on. Now, coach, if that is your goal, let's keep going. But if your goal is to be more explosive on Friday nights or Saturdays, then let's change our training to keep us explosive in our workout. So the data can get way too much if you don't know what you're looking at. But I don't look at too much stuff in a weight training session besides some bar speed, jump distance and a broad jump, the most basic thing. I don't need a force plate, even though I love Hawkins force plate, or speed times on a treadmill. Now, once when our jump distance goes down or our bar speed goes down or our treadmill speed goes down, they're all going to go down. So I'll tell a kid, hey, man, you're cooked. What do you mean I'm cooked? You're cooked. Let's work on something else. I want to keep working. No, we're going to keep working. But now instead of going a 15-yard sprint, I want you to work on a 10-yard sprint and a 5-yard decel. Why? That's going to slow him down, and he's still going to get the work in that's appropriate to what he needs. Hey, instead of blasting the treadmill and trying to get it up to 14, 15 miles an hour against the heaviest load as fast as you can, let's put up the hill. Let's just have him stride out for 8 seconds to get some movement in. You know, we start in that session rinsing out his legs and doing what? Affecting his conditioning, and then doing what? Improving his agility. You can do it all in a nice blended order, but sprinters aren't marathon runners. So just quit thinking that you're going to improve someone's sprint speed and conditioning in the same session. You've got to go sprint speed first, conditioning second, and not in the reverse order.
Love it. Love it. Sorry, so excited about so many things you've been saying. I can't pick which one to talk about first, but I love how you are using and how many people now are using data to either prove what works, prove what doesn't work, but in the process, taking care of the athletes, whether they're high school, college, or NFL guys, you're using data to prove this works, this doesn't work. Let's adjust here. Let's work there. You're evolving, which so many coaches in the past haven't been willing to do. It was always, well, this is what I did. This is my dad did. This is my uncles did. This is what we do.
Yeah.
Using data, it goes back to your college days, you know, being exposed to that data interpretation and those clinical studies, getting a kid to see that the data works sometimes as simple as, like you said, a 5 to 15 yard sprint and showing them the times. That's fantastic.
And if they're not at their PR or they're dead, it doesn't mean they don't work out. It just means you don't stress power or speed with them because their body doesn't have it that way.
Yeah.
And if you stress power or speed when they're not powerfully or sprint ready, you're going to increase injury.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, it would help that kid. Hey, man, you're kind of dead and not explosive today. Instead of squatting heavy, let's squat lighter and work on hurdle mobility. Okay. Now you made that kid better that day. Hey, man, you're not that fast today because I don't know. You didn't sleep well. You're not pushing good, whatever. You know what? Let's work on some wall drills and some sprint mechanics. Instead of sprinting fast day, let's make our mechanic better day. You know what you did that kid that day? You got him better. Versus, hey, you don't really feel good today. Your numbers aren't good. You don't feel good. I'm going to work you harder and make you feel worse.
Yep. Yep.
Like that type of mindset is starting to phase out finally.
Which is a good thing because, again, that's how they end up in the sports medicine clinic. That's when you end up injured. And that takes away from that young man, young woman's ability to play their sport.
100%.
100%. Now, you said over and over just gain, 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 but part of this is going to be nutrition as well. How do you help these young men, young women really focus on getting the best out of their performance with nutrition?
That's honestly probably one thing I'm not good at, and I deflect to other people. I mean, we try to convince them most of these kids, unless if they have to lose weight, are not eating enough, as we've all found out,
Amen.
Right? And just simple peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or protein bars that they like, two a day go a long way. We all find they're not eating breakfast. So it's like, hey, can you eat a breakfast? No. Okay, well, then you got to eat this bar at least,
Yep,
right?
yep.
But I'd rather you eat a breakfast than this bar at 10. But if you can't, eat this bar at 8 and wait till lunch, right? So just getting them to try to look at three meals a day with two snacks is the number one hurdle to overcome. And we even find it with our guys training for the NFL Combine that are elite of elite. We have to feed them. They have to eat. I don't believe in bad calories. I truly don't. But I believe in calories over anything if they're not eating. You know, they have to eat. So I try to get them to eat enough first and then make sure we clean it up second.
That's
And
a good thing.
Been my basics of that.
I hate to say it. We have bars in our facility for just such the occasion. I can't tell you how many of the young boys come up. You know, we'll have an early practice. Well, what'd you eat this morning?
Yeah.
You know, you're a little lightheaded, a little dizzy. Did you get hit? Or what'd you eat?
Yeah.
Well, I just, all I've had today is the Gatorade or the water that I drank. I haven't eaten anything.
Yeah.
Like, your tank's empty, buddy. The car can't drive.
Yeah.
You know, you need something inside.
You ate at 6 p.m. last night, and now it's 12 to 14 hours later.
Some of them don't
get
it
hard.
Sometimes. It is.
No, but it's hard. But I think I don't think they eat enough. I think you got to get them to eat enough first and then worry about what they're eating second. And then you can take the extreme cases. Who's not gaining enough and who's not losing enough? And that's like the bottom 10 or 20%. And probably then put them on like a strict meal plan that they have.
That's awesome. One thing we haven't really touched on, and just go there for a few minutes, hydration. I presume, especially in Florida, a little hot and humid, the few times I've been there, hydration in any situation is so important. Do you see that hydration makes a huge difference in the athlete's performance as they're coming across your table, your room, your facility?
100%. When you like look at Oura Rings or Whoops and all that, right? It totally picks out. I mean, the good way to show it, I mean, the younger kids aren't drinking. But when you drink alcohol, your body gets dehydrated. And when you show up in the morning, when an athlete shows up in the morning after they drank, they're whooping or their scores, their readiness scores suck. And it's mostly because of dehydration, right?
Yep.
So that's when we use it to tell kids, not drinking water is as bad as an old person going out and getting drunk the day before work. It's ruining your hydration. So, you know, it's like what everybody does. They carry around those water things. That does help. When you have kids carry around a jug or a thermostat that has to be filled up twice in a day or whatever, when you have kids do that, they're pretty good at, like, making sure they're drinking.
One of the few positives that came out of the whole COVID thing, and we won't go into that, but out here, we weren't allowed to give water to the boys. So we weren't, you know, you have the Gatorade bottles that you have set out. They had to bring their own. And since then, I have seen better hydration because the boys got used to carrying around those damn bottles that are heavy as hell.
That makes
keeps
sense.
Everything insulated. It has made a difference. Having those bottles
It is hard to drink enough water in a day, a gallon of water, whatever they say. You don't have to carry around a gallon. You got to carry around something because it's hard to drink a gallon without having something to fill up and constantly trying to drink.
You're not going to believe this, but we've already been talking for an hour. It goes by so fast, especially with these bundles.
It does go by fast.
I tell you what, I love listening to this data-driven stuff and information and learning. It's one thing you hate when you're in college and you get out and you're in your profession and you love it.
Yep.
So I'm not going to take too much more of your time, but if you could look at somebody, a young adult that's thinking about getting into exercise physiology and making a difference in whether it's a high school student, a college student, or even, you know, at the NFL combines, what is some advice you would give that young man, young woman that's looking to get into ex-phys and really helping others in the training realm?
The young student, I would try to tell them not to follow my path. My path wasn't there when I started it. So I kind of got lucky and created it, but now there's private gyms all over the place for sports training, right? I was one of the first that ever did it. So maybe I was lucky, whatever. Like, it was better for me. But I think what's out there now that wasn't out there when I was, and it's only going to get better is the strength and conditioning coach for the high school market. That's what I'm going to go back into because I love it so much. Because take it from me, I've trained elite of elite, you know, but nothing is as good as helping someone 12 to 15 years old. There's nothing like it. And
I love it. I love it myself. I got to agree with you.
And there's nothing more beneficial in a kid's life that plays sports to just get more medically, physically from when they're 12 to 15. And there's nothing better mentally than a strength and conditioning coach that kid trusts. And so like these top high schools in America are really seeing the importance of a strength and conditioning coach full-time in a high school for every single student athlete that coincides with the coaches. And it like makes their whole culture better on and off the field, a court. So like if I was a kid coming out or about to go to college, I'd be like, there are organizations out there that help groom high school strength and conditioning coaches. Like National High School Strength and Conditioning Association, one of them. Great organization. Maybe there's more. There are great paying jobs, great paying job, and consistency and schedule for you to have a life in the high school market that aren't available anywhere. The high school market now has great guys from college and pros that have been like, ain't worth it. I'm going to the high school market. And I think the younger generation needs to hear that and don't even look at a high school job as a stepping stone. I would look at it as this is a career. I just really would. And that wasn't around when I was around. So
I actually love how you say stepping stone. That's one of we actually did an episode not too long ago, and it was the step up to the high school. We had interviewed a couple athletic trainers that were at the collegiate level, high D1, you know, renowned schools, and the step up from the college setting to the high school setting, because it's so different and it's so impactful. And like you said, you got a almost normal schedule now, and you can have a life, you can have a family, and you can really focus on becoming a better person and helping those young men, young women become better people throughout their lives. So I love you mentioning that.
That's what I'm thinking I'm going to try to do is have an intern once a year, just a year-long intern that's paid hopefully by a private school. So they'll have a full-time strength coach that I get to mentor, and it's a year job. And then after that, I'm going to lay out for them, here are your options. Go to college and probably make less than what my internship just paid you, and go through a 6 to 8 year grind, which is fine. Try to go in the pros, same thing, or go move to a high school in a good area of your choice. And it's a good life. It's an impactful life. I still think you could do a private business a couple nights a week and on the weekends if you wanted to. I just think that is such an opportunity for young professionals to get into.
Tony, that's awesome. And I appreciate that. And I hope a young man, young woman listening out there really takes that to heart and sees the opportunity and seizes it, because it really can make a difference in so many young women and men's life as they're training at the, like you said, anywhere between 13, 14, all the way up to 18, depending on the, you know, the high school setting. So what a difference they make in those kids' lives.
100%.
And with that, sir, I'm going to let you get to your day, because I know as a businessman, time is money. We got to get you out there and get working. So I appreciate you. I appreciate everything we discussed today. I'm looking at the map of the shred mill locations, and you got a few. Huge.
There's about 175 out there.
Yeah, I'm looking at the locations, and there are several out by me. One a lot closer than I even thought. So maybe I'll have to go out and hurt myself without getting injured.
Go jump on.
And try it.
Yeah, go jump on.
Ah, I appreciate it.
No problem.
So thank you so much, Tony. You have a great day. Thanks for being on Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More. And we'll talk to you later. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you, Eli.
Bye-bye. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Want to make sure you hear every episode? Remember to like, follow, and subscribe to our podcast. Don't forget to share our podcast with your colleagues, family, and friends. Your support will help more people find and enjoy our content.
Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More is directed by Eli Halleck. It is produced by Gabriel Halleck. Our theme music is by Coma Studios via Pixabay. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the contributors. Want to know more about us? Visit us at wrapituppodcast.com. That's with one P, wrapituppodcast.com. Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More is a production of Halleck Consulting, LLC.